the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. This is Madhyamaka. This is the Indian school that this guy founded, right? So, but then you might say, well, and this is what we talked about last time, and it was astutely observed, doesn't this Dharma Dhatu form some kind of ultimate reality? It's like the ground of everything, right? Or Li here, principle, doesn't that suggest that there is some kind of foundation that all these phenomena sort of are occurring? And there's a kind of slippery Buddhist answer, which would be that the principle, or the ultimate nature of this principle in the Dharma Dhatu, is emptiness, right? And emptiness means that all things lack inherent existence. So it kind of turns itself back to the phenomena. So all things share the same nature, and that is the fact that they have no nature. All right, so that is the ultimate nature of everything, that it lacks any kind of nature, which means everything is dependent upon everything else. So, yeah.
Is it sort of reminiscent of George Barclay's idea that things cease to exist if there's no mind around to perceive
them? It's very similar. Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, the idea of the other school that I mentioned before, it's called the Yogacara school. And another name for them was Chittamatra, which means mind only. And so this is about as close as you get to what you could call Buddhist idealism in that kind of Barclayan sense of the word. But the Yogacaran school says that consciousness is real, but there's this kind of flow of consciousness, which is seamless kind of unity, and we break that up into subject and object. So it's not a static kind of, for instance, in Hindu philosophy, in the Advaita, the non-dual Hindu philosophy, they say the only thing that's real is pure being, consciousness, and bliss, and that's eternal and it's unchanging. So that means all phenomena that we experience is ultimately illusory. This isn't saying that. It's saying that the reality that we're experiencing now has some type of actual reality to it, in which the subject-object duality itself is not real. But Nagarjuna doesn't make that kind of strong claim that only consciousness is real. He just radically wants to assert that everything, including consciousness, lacks a self-nature. But when you kind of put these two together, what you end up with is that, okay, if everything is dependent upon everything else, the thing that pretty much everything has to be dependent on in some sense is consciousness. Because it doesn't have, there's no external reality outside of consciousness that we could possibly ever get to. So in that sense, it's like idealism.
Would it be the principle? Can you both say that consciousness is the principle?
I think it sometimes has been interpreted that way. When we talk about, when we look at the 10 mysterious gates, and which there's actually 12 of, they had to add two in there. It seems to suggest that mind is ultimately the same as principle. And mind, in a sense, is like Buddha mind, like this completely awakened mind that is really at one with everything. It encompasses all time, all space. Everything is encompassed in that mind. So that would tend to lean towards, that interpretation, that there's this kind of over mind or pure mind or Buddha nature. We'll see, especially when we get to Chan, they're pretty big on Buddha nature as this kind of awakened mind that is sort of the basis of reality. And the thing is, like, awakened mind exists in the same reality as sort of deluded mind, but, you know, deluded minds break everything up into subject and objects and think that there's a real world external to themselves, whereas awakened mind doesn't do that, right? Because remember when I read that quote that comes when the Maitreya walks back into the tower, right? And he says, arise, son of good family. He's talking to Sudarana, the hero. He says, this is the nature of conditioned factors. That's dharmas, okay? It's another translation of dharmas. So son of good family, characterized by their non-fixity, all conditioned factors, that is dharmas, are controlled through the knowledge of bodhisattvas. In this way, lacking the perfection of essence, that's svabhava right there, they are like illusions, dreams, and reflections, right? So basically it's saying is that these advanced spiritual beings, they can actually manipulate and they can control reality. They can generate kind of reality from their knowledge. And if not, you know, you think of knowledge as a kind of, as a mental thing, right? So in some sense, like, what they're basically manipulating is some kind of mental stuff. Like, through the power of their own minds, they're able to generate their own realities because everything is like dreams or illusions. Just like if you were in a lucid dream, and you're like, oh yeah, I want a Coke, or I want to be on the beach in Hawaii, or, you know, I want a supermodel on my arm. You could just make these things, like, appear, right? Because they have no inherent existence outside the consciousness that's experiencing the dream.
But just because you can understand them doesn't suggest to me that you can control or create them. Like, that doesn't suggest to me a causal kind of...
Well, the idea from this end of things, like, real knowledge of the true nature of things basically gives you mastery over them. In the same way, I guess I'm liking this lucid dream metaphor, and I'm sticking to it. In the same way that once you realize that you're actually dreaming in a dream, you can do that. How can you do that? How can we don't even know, I mean, we don't even really understand what dreaming is, right? But we know that we can do that, but we put it in a different we put dreams in a different ontological status, right? We say that, well, a dream's in your head, wherever that is, right? And so the space in the dream and the person, the characters in the dream, including your own dream self and all things in it, don't exist outside of your consciousness. And somehow knowing that allows you to just generate stuff out of nothing. And basically what this Gandavyuha is saying, and Avatamsaka and Flower Ornament and wider Mahayana and then the Huayan, is saying that, like, actual reality, what we would call real, works on the same principle. So that understanding the emptiness of things, and that's, again, emptiness is a key. Realizing the emptiness of things allows one to gain mastery over basically reality. You can change the fabric of reality.
So. Yeah, 'cause I feel like if that was the case, what's one level down from the water
again? Oh, like a bodhisattva?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Bodhisattvas would have changed some things because of their compassion.
They would, except our karma only allows us to experience the reality that that we're in now. So only the only reason why we're not seeing the interpenetration of all time and space and bodhisattvas like Maitreya and Manjushri are walking in the door, you know, wanting to party, is because we don't have the karma. I mean, it's better than the beings that are hungry ghosts or in hells or are animals, but...
That's still suggesting that the bodhisattva has the power to do it in their own realm, which would be more like dreaming again, and it seems like they're not going to affect our experience.
Well,
so what's this realm then, where things can't be affected?
I see what you're saying, but that would, and I know the point you're getting at. There's a paradox here, because the thing is, these really advanced spiritual beings, like Buddhas and like 10th stage bodhisattvas, are supposed to be practically limitless in their power, but also sentient beings are limitless in their number, And so the question is, which one's more, which one trumps the other one, right? They're not all powerful, but they're pretty close to it. So the question would be, well, why are we still here? Why can't we see them? Why aren't we suffering? Because if they're so great, they'd be trying to help us, and we wouldn't be experiencing this. Then you're starting to get into sort of religious questions about, you know, I think if you lean on it too hard, it cracks will appear. But the idea would be that we're not experiencing that because of our karma. That would be the short answer to that.
I wouldn't suggest that thought, you know, why haven't they saved the wars and all that kind of thing?
Right.
I mean, why haven't we just seen a random new thing that never existed pop up somewhere because they called it? Like,
yeah, again, we're
evidence of small things like that.
Well, again, the idea would be, remember I talked about at the end of class last time that at the beginning of the Gandavyuha, the Buddha enters into this trance state, transforms the grove that he's in into this infinite, vast, jeweled space. All the bodhisattvas there see this, but all the disciples don't. They just see the Buddha sitting there, you know, in an ordinary grove. And so they're the complete absence. And so that would the reality, according to this view, the reality that we're experiencing is conditioned by our karma. We're not limited to that. Like, oh, you could just go into a trance from me teaching you now and have the samadhi and then realize that actually linear time and space is just a fiction, and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. That possibility is always there. But they go on about this at quite some length, too. Like, for instance, you know, have you guys been down to the Turitea stream on campus? Yeah, okay. So they would say, like from the Buddhist point of view, we see it as a stream made out of water. But the gods, celestial beings, would see it like a stream of ambrosia. Hell beings would like see it as like a stream of like lava. Whereas like hungry ghosts would see it as like a stream of pus. Right? So the idea being that the different realms of existence are the way they are because of the karma of the beings that are kind of aggregated there. That there is.
You actually move through these like creative perspectives around the subject. Like there are all these bubbles of kind of moving around these perspectives. So everything is as it is, but like the perspective of it depends kind of on like the level where you're at.
Yes, I mean. Yes, what you're saying is true. I mean, that you could also raise the question, well, is there really a stream there at all if everyone's only experiencing there? Because it kind of assumes there is a real stream that all these beings are experiencing differently, but there's not even that, like nothing that you could say anyway. But yes, you're right in the second part of what you said, in the sense of, like, from this point of view, you know, because all time and space interpenetrate, the reason why we don't have immediate access to all of it is only due to our limited perspective. So all the other all celestial beings and hell beings and hungry ghosts and spirits and demons and all that stuff, they're all like right here, right now. But we're just experiencing like this classroom down in the basement of Sir Geoffrey Perrin building because we've all been conditioned through our karma in this lifetime and countless previous lifetimes to experiencing this in this way.
So does it come back down to the notion of animus, that what they see depends on their mind, which is depending on their karma?
Yes. Yes, it would. It would. And the deeper your penetration into the ultimate illusory nature of phenomena, right, the more expansive one's ability to more expansive one's vision of reality, and the more expansive one's power to actually like control and manipulate that reality.
That would be horrifying because it would suggest that the initial moment of your
Yeah, that would be a Zen term. Yeah, Zen term of enlightenment, flash of enlightenment. Yeah.
You would see all timelines at once right here, and see all the things, all the hundred ghosts, everything, all the humans from the past. You see it all at once.
That would be a possibility.
Like, oh, okay, now I have control. I'll clear that and tune it into a jeweled Indra so I can show the bodhisattva. But before that, you'd be like, oh, it's all happening.
It could be something. It could be. It's never happened to me, but it could be something like that. Yeah, it could be. It could be. And it would be from YN. I mean, there's this kind of pared down version of enlightenment where it's just you realize non-duality, which is a bit like, okay. And it's a bit, or you realize the emptiness of everything. It's a bit like lacking content. But this is a very like expansive, visionary thing. There's more of a kind of a fullness to it than a kind of lack to it. So instead of saying that everything is just non-dual and you'd be like, okay, I can't experience it that because everything I experience is dualistically versus, yeah, like the all time and space. Yeah, and it would be everything, all time, all space, all reality, infinite complexity, interpenetrating. Yeah, bam, all at once, download. Yeah. Pretty trippy. Okay, so good. I think we're getting a little bit of taste of what's going on here. So what I wanted to do now is then talk about, I wanted to read this other example of the jeweled gnat just to show you, this is a translation from a text, Huayan text, and then look at some different concepts that are important to Huayan. So this is, there are no page numbers, I can't give you the page number, but in the middle of chapter 7, it's a quote from a text by Tushun, who is the first Huayan patriarch, a treatise called Cessation and Contemplation. And he says, he describes Indra's net, and then he suggests to his interlocutor, someone who he's having this sort of debate with, that he pick one random jewel from the southwest and examine it. He then states, "This jewel can show the reflections of all the jewels all at once. And just as this is so of this jewel, so it is of every other jewel. The reflection is multiplied and remultiplied over and over endlessly. These infinitely multiplying jewel reflections are all in one jewel and show clearly. The others do not hinder this. If you sit in one jewel, then you are sitting in all the jewels in every direction multiplied over and over. Why? Because in one jewel, there are all jewels. If there is one jewel and all jewels, then you are sitting in all the jewels too. And the reverse applies to the totality if you follow the same reasoning. Since in one jewel, you go into all jewels without leaving this one, so all the jewels enter one jewel without leaving this one jewel." So this is an example of what they call in Huayan the all-in-one and one-in-all. In other words, within a single point of space, the totality of space is contained. And likewise, this applies to time, too. Huayan, the Avatamsaka Sutra, if you ever wanted to read it, all 1,500 pages of it, it's obsessed with the number 10. Everything is 10. 10, 10, 10, 10. There's some kind of weird number mysticism going on there that no one's really talked about in detail. But and this is why I think, remember I talked about it has 10 mysterious gates, but they're really 12. Well, they had to say they were 10, because otherwise they'd be breaking the whole 10 thing. But they just slipped in a couple extra two. And the 10th gate has like, you know, 10 A, B, and C or something. But they also, there's 10 times, right? So there's the past, present, and future. And then there's the past, present, and future of the future. How do they do it? Okay, here we go. They assert that within a single instant of time, the totality of time, past, present, and future, is contained. And so they have like past, present, and future, and then they have the past, present, and future of the present, past, present, and future of the past, present, and future of the present, and so then they have all of it together so they can get 10, right? Whereas normally you think, okay, you just got the past, present, and future, right? 3, but they expand that into the 10, they're 10 times, just so they can have 10, right? But anyway, the idea being the same that, you know, these metaphors that we're using here, golden line, mirror room, jeweled net, they're all spatial, right? So they don't really give any indication of time, but the idea is that not only does all time interpenetrate, but all space interpenetrates.
When is this you sit in one jewel, you sit in all jewels.
Mm-hmm.